This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Morning, everybody. David Shapiro here with a video. So today's video is about the cyberpunk dystopian future that we are heading towards, and then also how to avoid it. So, jump right into the show. Let's talk about cyberpunk. Let's characterize this genre. So the first thing that you need to know about cyberpunk is that the central theme, the central motif that was enshrined, I think, back in the late 80s, was high-tech, low-life. So everything about cyberpunk orbits around this concept. High-tech advancements, but everyone is living kind of a low-life, you know, deteriorated social structures, socioeconomic divides, inequality, poverty, that sort of thing. So you see this repeated in everything from Blade Runner to cyberpunk and a whole slew of movies. And also, if it seems like I'm going kind of quick in this video, it's because there's a lot of slides to cover, and we will go over these things several times. Another feature of cyberpunk is that everything is for sale. Whether you want human life, experiences, emotions, sex, everything is absolutely for sale. This is explored in particular in Altered Carbon, where the ultra elite will do everything from buying and cloning their own bodies to purchasing experiences where they literally like murder people for fun, that sort of thing. So everything is for sale in a cyberpunk universe. Another thing is that nothing is sacred in a cyberpunk universe. Traditional values have been replaced with corporate values. Everything has been commoditized and trivialized. So whatever you want to sell, it's for sale because, once again, nothing is sacred. This has to do with disillusionment and skepticism towards traditional power structures. Again, we see this quite extensively in Blade Runner, particularly Blade Runner 2049. And one of the kind of most dystopian things was that the central theme, or I guess one of the goals of the villain in 2049 was to get the replicants to be able to reproduce sexually, so therefore you could have unlimited slaves, which is, of course, an exaggeration of kind of the worker drone mentality that people have today. But again, the idea that nothing is sacred, including human reproduction, childbirth, motherhood, that sort of thing, is exemplified here in that paradigm of nothing is sacred. State of decay. So one of the most common visual elements is that everything seems rusted or disintegrating. And the reason for this is because the government is often depicted as corrupt, ineffective, or just absent. And so that means infrastructure is not being maintained. There is a loss of faith in the government's ability to do anything. And so this is shown repeatedly in games, movies, and books. Basically, you see urban decay, dirty streets, where everything is just kind of haphazardly stacked on top of each other. So that visual chaos is also part of the motif. And the reason is because it indicates that there's no central planning, that it's kind of a free-for-all, which is another example of the abdication of government responsibility. Unadulterated id. So in this case, I mean id in the Freudian sense of superego, ego, and id. And so if you're not familiar with the concept of id, it is the primal instincts and base desires that all humans have for pleasure, aggression, greed, those sorts of things, gluttony, basically the seven deadly sins. But rather than contain those with social mores, a sense of decorum, they're celebrated and exploited. And so this, for instance, is one reason that we see like heckling as a thing that's happening more and more in American politics, is because it's basically enabling and celebrating trolling rather than any sense of decency or decorum. And so the constraints of society's superego, the moral compass, or the dignity that we want to hold ourselves to is no longer in place. And so instead we focus on immediate gratification, consequences be damned. This has to do with that ongoing commodification of desires. So basically the algorithm manipulates what you want to see, which is why we have things today like thirst traps. So this is actually something that's actually happening. And again, it was predicted and described in plenty of works of fiction throughout the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Utter abandonment. And so this is something that is implied, but people rarely talk about. But basically, social structures break down. Community supports, government supports have been systematically either trashed or abandoned, which basically means that people need to adopt a disposition of rugged individualism or tight-knit group survival, because nobody's going to look out for you. And this, again, has to do with the abdication of government responsibility. Hyper-competition prevails, which rewards cutthroat tactics and power-seeking behavior. That's another central theme in pretty much all cyberpunk genre media. And so basically, power-seeking is not just accepted, but it is rewarded and exploited. And this is also part of the fabric of society today, which we'll go over in just a moment.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
And so then the lack of social safety nets means that basically, you know, you combine the lawlessness from the absenteeism of the government with this rewarding of cutthroat mentalities, and that's why you have this really kind of hard-boiled sink or swim motif in all cyberpunk media. Authoritarian brutality. So when you basically get rid of, you know, law enforcement as a public service, then it becomes a tool of the powerful elite or privatized corporations or both. And so then it becomes a blunt instrument of oppression and control rather than a social service. This is portrayed with the police forces of the cyberpunk world having a lack of accountability, for instance, often acting with impunity and acting a little bit gross. And this resonates with society today, because often police are given the benefit of the doubt and are not really necessarily held to consequences. This is a reflection of growing inequality and the consolidation of power amongst the wealthy elite. We see this in Cyberpunk 2077 with Militech, which is a fully privatized police force and military force. We also see this in Altered Carbon with the Praetorians, which are just this like super high-tech, highly trained paramilitary force that is used to crack down on pretty much like any dissent. And finally, corporate feudalism. So corporate feudalism is basically the consolidation of mega corporations, which gives them control of everything, all aspects of society, all goods and services, including politics and culture, which they use, mass media campaigns, PR campaigns, and controlling the narrative to basically shape the entirety of your experience. in these cases, in cyberpunk worlds, they basically act as sovereign entities, replacing governments. Again, one of the recurring themes is the abdication or absence of government. And so this is where corporate loyalty replaces national allegiance. And of course, we see this reflected in society today, where we have media that kind of pokes fun at the idea that, like, your company is your family, which is complete and utter BS. This is also a reflection of the unchecked power and growth of corporations, where profit motives overrule literally everything else. And corporations get to dictate reality through controlling media, through controlling advertising, and public perception through narratives. So again, we see this a lot in many, many forms of media. Okay, so a lot of this seems really real, doesn't it? There's a reason for that, so let's get into why. The primary reason that everything in cyberpunk seems a little too real is neoliberalism. And so I've mentioned neoliberalism a few times in past videos, and so we're going to go over it really quickly with a little bit new context. So we have these two to thank in the Western world for codifying and enshrining neoliberalism in the Western world. So Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher were both elected around the same time, and both of them had fully drank the Kool-Aid of neoliberalism. Okay, so what is the Kool-Aid of neoliberalism? There are a bunch of principles of neoliberalism. And so you might hear this word like, oh, liberalism, therefore it's communism or socialism. No, it's literally the exact opposite. So neoliberalism is a really disgusting euphemism for what we have today. Now, that being said, GDP is going up, so like it has worked in that respect. But when we connect cyberpunk to neoliberalism, you'll see why it's really awful. So first, marketization. If something is outside the market, bring it into the market. Commoditize all goods and services. Again, everything is for sale. Privatization, transfer public goods and services to private ownership in the name of efficiency. Again, pretty gross. You take that out to the logical conclusion, and that's why we see stuff like Militech and the trauma team in Cyberpunk 2077, where if you don't have money, you're excluded from the system. Deregulation, again, abdication of government responsibility. The government says, you know, we're actually going to take our hands off the wheel and just trust the market to work it out on its own. Shrinking the government. So reducing government spending, reducing government intervention, and basically, again, continuing to take your hands off the wheel. Free trade. Remove trade barriers to foster movement of more goods and services. This is not necessarily intrinsically evil, but it does support offshoring, which means that, like, you know, that's why we have the Rust Belt, or part of the reason that we have the Rust Belt here in America. But also one of the dark sides of free trade is that free trade of what? Of human flesh, of, you know, trafficking, you know, minors and sex trafficking and all kinds of stuff. So it's like you can easily just kind of adapt that, say, like, you know, free trade at all costs to things that are maybe shouldn't be traded. Fiscal austerity. So again, reduce government spending to encourage privatization, and lowering taxes for the rich, basically trickle-down economics. Flexible labor markets. So flexible labor markets is a very euphemistic way for undermining labor protections, and it is in the name of enhancing flexibility for employers. Basically, employment at will means that you can be fired at any time for any reason, and then also you undermine labor unions in order to fully remove bargaining power for workers. So this is why over the last 40 years, corporations have been able to basically take this mentality, particularly in America, where they can treat you however they wish. They only treat you as good as they are required to by law in order to be competitive in the labor market. Economic efficiency. So basically use efficient market theory to aim for economic efficiency above all else. Entrepreneurship. You know, that's pretty standard. But the idea, one thing is that strong property rights is one of the reasons, one of the things embedded in neoliberalism, which is why it's, because the theory was you have very strong property rights, you encourage entrepreneurship that includes intellectual property, which means that people are incentivized to build companies. And so basically the idea was, let's do neoliberalism. And so then some people can become billionaires or trillionaires, and they will be incentivized because the underpinning theory of human nature is that people are just intrinsically greedy and that there will never be enough, that the more you can get, the more you want. And so this was codified and enshrined in neoliberalism, which is why we have such strong property laws. And a lot of people have drank the Kool-Aid of strong property laws. Most notably, the people who tend to be most excluded from this, which is the anarcho-capitalists and diehard libertarians. It's very interesting. The people who have the least property are often the most fixated on property law. Anyways, globalization, international commerce, and offshoring trade, again, it goes back to free trade. And then finally, inflation control. So rather than using monetary policy for social means, such as maintaining standard of living and employment, it is use monetary policy to control inflation. The idea was that using monetary policy to control inflation would create a more stable environment in which people could flourish, but by deprioritizing social goals, it kind of, you stop measuring it. And so basically, neoliberalism in a nutshell is maximize economic growth through free market principles, and to heck with everything else. Okay, so let's provide some historical context as to how and why neoliberalism happened. What was the philosophical and cultural zeitgeist that led to this? So first, nihilism. Our good friend nihilism basically said nothing has any meaning. And another way of saying that is that nothing is sacred. Nothing is sacred, but the will to power is all that matters. Power-seeking behavior and power-seeking mentalities, acquiring more power for its own sake and no other purpose. That's what nihilism, maybe it's not what people said, because I can already hear some people in the audience saying, well, actually. And so here's the thing is, there's what something says in theory and how it is actually interpreted and used. And so this is very common where things are kind of simplified once they get out into the world. And so, yes, I know that some crusty old philosopher said that this is what it means. But in reality, the way that nihilism has been applied is that nothing is sacred and power-seeking behavior is good. Postmodernism came in the mid-20th century, so about 50 to 60 years later, also said nothing is sacred, and that includes virtues, values, or truth. And so this postmodernism says, let's reject all narratives just because we can't come to consensus on a few things, so we're just going to categorically reject everything and throw the baby out with the bathwater. Well, that created a power vacuum of intellectual, moral, philosophical values and virtues and truth, and guess who filled that vacuum? Corporations. And so corporations said, well, okay, so if the intelligentsia is going to bicker and kind of implode because of postmodernism, we are more than happy to fill the void with narratives, advertising, and PR campaigns. And so the intellectuals of the mid-20th centuries really shot all of ourselves in the foot. And this set the stage for neoliberalism. Neoliberalism basically was a economic extension of nihilism and postmodernism, which said, well, nothing is sacred. We don't actually care about human values and human dignity because, well, nobody can agree on it. And so then that really set the stage of saying, okay, well, maybe we just maximize for market efficiency above all else, because you guys already told us that morals and values and philosophy don't really matter anymore. And again, I know that that's not what postmodernism actually said, but that is the fallout. That is looking at postmodernism from an economic lens and from a business lens. It's like, well, we're allowed to define virtues and values now, so we're going to redefine your relationship to work. We're going to redefine your relationship to consumerism. And that is the zeitgeist flowing directly from nihilism to postmodernism to neoliberalism. And that is why we have cyberpunk. And that is why we have had flat wages for the last 40 plus years. Neoliberalism has failed the people. Now, GDP has continued going up. Great. But neoliberalism has failed the people. And this is why we have cyberpunk as a genre. So let me just drive this home. Cyberpunk equals neoliberalism. Everything that you see in the cyberpunk universe is a commentary and exaggeration of directly taken from neoliberal policies. It is not an accident that cyberpunk as a genre was created in the early 80s immediately after the global rise of neoliberalism. Cyberpunk is that cautionary representation of the inevitable conclusion of neoliberal policies. Unbridled corporatism, for instance. Everything is for sale. Marketize and commoditize everything. Privatize, shrink government, abdication of government. You're on your own. So now, obviously, cyberpunk is fiction. It is a slight exaggeration. But that being said, it's less and less an exaggeration of what we're actually seeing out there in the world. And so this is why these stories resonate so much right now. It is time for something new. So what do we replace it with? We need an entirely new framework, an entirely new doctrine, and an entirely new set of assumptions. But what do we replace it with? This is where I beat on the drum of post-labor economics. So post-labor economics is specifically an economic theory and policy and set of doctrines and principles meant to directly replace neoliberalism. So the primary mission of post-labor economics, if neoliberalism was to maximize market efficiency and market growth, or maximize maximize economic growth through free market principles, the primary mission of post-labor economics is to decouple human welfare from economics, to fully separate our well-being from the economic engines of humanity. We want to disentangle monetary and fiscal policy from human dignity, because right now they're still married, where the idea was that your personal prosperity and dignity was directly tied to the economy, which was directly tied to your job. But with post-labor economics, that is not going to be the case anymore, and we're rapidly heading in that direction, and this is a set of principles and policies, a new paradigm that we will need in order to achieve this, and it will be necessary sooner rather than later. So, what are the principles of post-labor economics? We went over the principles of neoliberalism, so let's set an entirely new, or let's create an entirely new set of economic principles. Principle number one, accelerate automation. Let's replace human labor as quickly as possible. Get humans out of the workforce. Number two, disentangle progress. Remove human bottlenecks from scientific, medical, and economic progress. We want to use machines to go as quickly as possible. Number three, universal welfare. Guarantee basic goods and services. Enshrine human dignity as part of our economic doctrine. Number four, redistribute wealth. With getting humans out of the way, with turning the economy up to 11 and accelerating economic stuff, we'll also need to create new economic cycles and systems in order to capture some of that wealth and redistribute it to everyone. Democratize technology, such as using open source and public intellectual property, as well as public funding. Number six, strengthen democracy. Enhance institutions to fight corporate power. This is where we need to literally just reverse course from neoliberalism, where neoliberalism said, take your hands off the wheel. Take your hands off the reins. We need to reverse course because that really hasn't worked out for us. We need to, number seven, drive down prices. Use AI to collapse prices as much as possible. Number eight, adopt holistic metrics. When we decouple the economy from human dignity, GDP is going to have even less of an impact on our individual lives, you and me. Localization, number nine, onshore vital resources, goods and services, and support and promote circular economies. And number 10, include the natural world, price in the environment, and add things like extraction tax. So now let's go into these principles in a little bit more depth. So for under accelerate automation, number one, obviously just embrace innovation. This is a big part of what I do professionally and with my YouTube channel, which is let's teach businesses how to use AI to automate as much as possible. Now this frees up human potential, the second part of this, to more creative and meaningful and productive pursuits, which is, okay, how do we go further faster? Or how do we pay attention to our own lives and develop more sense of well-being and meaning? This will boost the economy by accelerating growth and reducing labor costs, yada, yada, yada. You get the point. Encourage flexibility. By deploying AI and building more and more AI tools, this will have broad spectrum effects on the economy. Disentangle progress. So part two is removing those bottlenecks. If we can reduce or remove our reliance on human labor, then that means the next limiting factor is going to be how fast and how smart and how much AI you have. Then that will allow us to focus on what we're better at, whether it's creativity or higher level tasks, at least until those tasks get replaced by AI. Unlocking potential and fostering inclusivity, sure, you know, boilerplate ideas, but the idea is disentangling progress from human constraints. Universal welfare, this is basically guaranteeing some level of dignity where we say, okay, we did an experiment where we said that human dignity was no longer the responsibility of government, and we don't like that. It actually really made us angry, and it was very dystopian. And so now we're going to say that ensuring dignity is actually, once again, absolutely the responsibility of the government. And so this is by promoting equality, building security and safety nets, and fostering social cohesion through those shared benefits of, you know, hey, here's the New Deal where, you know, your job goes away, but you will be taken care of. Redistribution of wealth. So this is basically going to be necessary for this final reason, which is just to offset deflation. This is one thing that a lot of you point out on my videos, which is that if we all lose our jobs, then we don't have any money and we can't patronize the companies that want our money anyways. So basically, we're going to need to have new economic cycles and new patterns of circulation of wealth in order to basically keep the economy running. So redistribution of wealth, not on some lofty principle, but just out of sheer dumb necessity, some form of redistribution of wealth will be absolutely necessary sooner rather than later. Democratizing technology. So, you know, push open source. This is a big reason that I have enshrined as much of my work as I can in the public domain, whether through the MIT license or the Creative Commons Zero license. And so the reason that I do this is because the more space I take up and guarantee that something is in the public domain, the less that other people can use friction to slow it down. And so this is one thing that I still agree with neoliberalism, and I didn't write this down, but that is to reduce friction. So democratizing technology is about reducing friction so that anyone can use it, corporations, private citizens, governments around the world, because that is one way to make sure that we all have equal access to the benefits of it. If everyone has access to it, then it's not special anymore. And that's okay, though, because everyone has access to air, but you need it. So just because everyone has access to it and it's not special anymore doesn't mean that you don't need it. So democratized technology. Number six, strengthen democracy. So strengthening democracy means strengthening institutions, the resilience of government, transparency for accountability. This is really critical, and this is something that many Western countries do okay at. They could do better. Increasing citizen involvement, such as by enshrining like national holidays for voting. That's one way. Protecting rights, whether it's civil rights, social rights, collective rights, that sort of thing. Expanding the government, deliberately expanding the government to have a more active role in the economy and everything else. Because again, one of the principles of neoliberalism is to deliberately have government pull back. Well, now the government has receded too much, and it's time to come back into full focus a little bit more. And that is, kind of reversing course from neoliberalism. I'm not saying that we need to have gigantic government and huge government overreach, but what I'm saying is that the government has receded too much, and now we need the government to come back. Another thing is using AI, using these new technologies to maximize the efficiency of government so that the government can do more with less and that it can do it better, faster, safer, cheaper. Drive down prices. So this is one of the number one things that's going to support a post-scarcity environment or a hyperabundance economy, which is use artificial intelligence and all the new technologies to reduce costs across the board. And now, one thing that I anticipate that's going to happen with this, though, is that we might drive down the price of some goods and services so much that they're not going to be sustainable as private industries. And so in those cases, I think what we'll probably need to do is subsidize those. So for instance, one thing that I predict is that within about 10 to 20 years, hospitals are going to start to just completely collapse, but we're still going to need them. And so then I suspect that hospitals will either become municipal services or highly subsidized services. We'll see how that plays out. And it'll probably vary a lot from region to region. There'll probably be some places where hospitals are just run by the county, for instance, in more rural places. But I can imagine in more urban places, hospitals will probably be more like subsidized private companies. We'll see how that plays out. Holistic metrics. So again, as I mentioned a moment ago, GDP is not going to be a good metric for personal well-being anymore, because literally the point of post-labor economics is to divorce human well-being from the economy. So GDP will still be there to measure the economy. And of course, the economists are still going to be like, okay, cool, you know, growth is good. There's some debate about that because GDP growth is slowing down. So we might enter into a plateau or a degrowth phase just by virtue of the fact that GDP growth is slowing down and there doesn't seem to be anything we can do about it. We'll see if AI affects that. But what we do need to do is focus on metrics of well-being, such as mental, physical, social health for the people, because the government exists of the people, for the people, by the people, and it is not serving the people right now. So we need more holistic metrics to measure the government. We the people need to have a government report card to determine whether or not the government is serving us and our needs and our wants. And so we need to take back power. And the way that you take back power is that you have better metrics and new metrics. So focusing on sustainability and balance as an example of those kinds of things. Localizing economies. So bringing resources, goods, and services back onshore closer to the point of consumption. This just makes sense. And we're facing deglobalization right now anyways. And so let's just enshrine this and say, yes, it's actually better if you depend on food, water, and other goods and services that are, let's say, within a 100-mile radius of you, because then you're not dependent upon whatever's going on the other side of the world. There's a lot of good reasons for this, not the least of which is national security and economic stability. This includes circular economies, which is basically like... The next generation of recycling, where you have inputs and outputs that all kind of circulate in a local region, which is much more efficient. And so this is focusing on resiliency and reducing global interdependence, because one of the reasons that we promoted global interdependence was after World War II, the prevailing theory was that global interdependence would reduce war, because if you're economically dependent upon your neighbor, you're less likely to declare war on them. But as we're heading towards a multipolar world future, at least in the near term, where it's basically entire continents have consolidated, I don't think that global interdependence works. Economic interdependence across, you know, North America and across Europe and across Asia as those geographically constrained regions, I think that makes sense. I don't think it yet makes sense to have one global economy right now. And then including the natural world, we need to price in the environment. And we already see people experimenting with this with things like carbon tax, because the idea is, okay, well, you're polluting, so we're going to tax that because, you know, we need to offset. And one, you want to disincentivize pollution, but you also need to offset the harm that's being done and hypothetically use those carbon taxes to help the environment. But I think that what we need to do is, rather than, you know, say, oh, well, we need to remove the environment from the market, we just need to price it in. We need to have more experiments such as carbon taxes, maybe more extraction taxes. Value-added taxes are something that's really popular in other parts of the world. But the idea is that we essentially need a sustainability tax. We need to make sure that everything that we do is priced for sustainability, and that means moving away from an extraction-based model. And finally, we need a new social contract. So we need to redefine the role of business and government, which is kind of what I'm talking about here, which is, okay, corporations are way too big, way too powerful. We need to dial that back. On the other hand, the government has been dialed back too much, so now we need to dial it back up. This also is pivoting from a purely growth-centric model to a human-centric model, focused on human needs and well-being. And then it's also about alignment, because we all want some of the same things. We all want to have a more prosperous economic future. we just all want to make sure that we're all participating. And so one of the central kind of motifs of neoliberalism was, okay, well, just make the pie bigger, right? Everyone wants a piece of pie, so you make the pie bigger. Well, that mentality doesn't necessarily work, especially if you've got one person controlling the pie cutter. So you need a more fair way of distributing a larger pie. And this includes by aligning values and shared goals, but above all else, long-term thinking. Short-term thinking is highly incentivized right now across at every level of society. I have a friend who's a civil engineer, and she was telling us about how a lot of civil projects, they're literally thinking in 2-year cycles because they're like, okay, well, I'm going to spend money here so that I can get reelected. And so this is why a lot of American cities are very haphazard, is because zoning laws and, you know, property sales and all that kind of thing are done with very, very short-term thinking. And short-term thinking is really dumb because we're capable of much longer-term thinking. But the reason that long-term thinking and decisions that are good for the long-term aren't made is because we have short-term incentives. Okay, so really important question. When do we adopt post-labor economics? So there's 4 primary signals that I've identified that we can use to determine when it is time to move to post-labor economics. It's not yet, but it will be soon. So 1, rising employment. If you see employment creeping up and not going back down, it's time to start talking about post-labor economics. Declining labor participation rate. So we kind of already see this. I think America peaked at about 66% a few years ago, and now it's hovering around 63%. So I suspect that total labor participation rate is going to continue to decline. And so as that drifts down, that's going to be a second signal to pay attention to for post-labor economics. 3 is falling prices. So as we deploy more AI, as some of these other principles that I've talked about, which is, you know, encourage competition, use AI to collapse prices of goods and services, we should see falling prices ideally start to happen. And so as prices go down, then it becomes more economically feasible to create more entitlements, such as, you know, guaranteeing access to basic goods and services. And finally, increasing deflationary pressures, such as job loss, people having less money, and the economy becoming more lopsided, where people have less purchasing power. That's going to lead to deflation. And like I said a few slides ago, there's going to be a lot of things that need to be done, such as redistribution of wealth, just by sheer virtue of the economy is going to stall out if we don't do that. And so these are the kind of the 4 primary economic trends that I've identified to pay attention to for when it is time to implement post-labor economics. Thank you for watching. I hope you got a lot out of this. Stay tuned for more. And yeah, cheers.